From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Hey, tremendous Friday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Colin Donovan is in the house ready to answer your questions. Simply pick up the phone and give us a call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. And if you are outside the United States and Canada, we'd love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email, openline@ewtn.com, or you can text your question to Colin. Text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for a response. Text your first name and your question. Message and data rates may apply. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Jeff Burson handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every Friday, the aforementioned Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Jack. Trying to stay out of trouble as usual.
Yeah, well, try harder.
I know. Impossible.
Let's talk a little bit at the beginning. I'm going to put you on the spot. We didn't prepare anything, but various dioceses are approaching this differently, but we are in the synodal year that is leading up to the synod, and. Yeah. A lot of people are reading about this and don't have any idea what anybody is talking about.
Yeah, and actually had a couple questions on that by email and other medium. It's something that seems foreign to the Western Church. It's not foreign to the Eastern Church. They've had a synodal form of governance pretty much from the beginning. From the Roman point of view, it's because although they have patriarchs usually in each of their churches, they haven't had the Pope. So the patriarch, the bishops come together, they elect bishops. And those churches which have, those who have reunited with Rome and belong to the Eastern Catholic churches, still use that form of leadership. The role of the laity there is, as it is in the Western Church, advisory, obviously. They don't exercise hierarchical authority. And so, in that way, what is being proposed here is just an extension of that practice. What has been practiced since the Second Vatican Council on the level of the Roman See anyway, there is an ongoing synodal body in the Holy See, which organizes the synods of bishops for usually every number, so many numbers of years. We've had synods on the family over time under the various popes. We've had synods on penance and so on under John Paul II. We had the Synod of the Americas and of the other continents during the Jubilee year and so on. To take information of what needs to be done, to get the collective understanding and will of the bishops of what needs to be done in the church or in a particular part of the church. And so the collective understanding part is what the local synods will try to, they will talk to laity, they will talk to the clergy, they will gather information. It will be collated, I understand, at the national level, and then it will go to Rome. And the result of this will be not a sort of democratic process. People are mistaken if they think that. But rather that to achieve a sort of sensus fidelium, I think, of the church, of what is critical in our day. And a sensus fidelium, Fidelium means that it is not just the hierarchy, but also the people. And it's the unity of view which creates that census. So we're looking in all throughout the world, in all of the churches, among the clergy, among the laity, and of course, particularly with the hierarchy, what is the sense of what has to be done in the church to move forward in our extremely complicated times, which seem day by day to get even more complicated. So what people will be hearing about in their own dioceses are the synods for their dioceses and what will be done, how the bishop, they're following the guidelines, obviously. You know, how that will be done some have said town halls. It's not really a town hall, but listening sessions, whether at the parish level or at the diocesan level, to gather that first cut at the information, if you will, what seems to be the sense of what needs to be done. And obviously the bishop will be the one to approve whatever goes on to the next highest level, the bishop's conference, and so on. So these kinds of things will be taking place. I think it has the possibility of great fruit. Obviously, there's also the possibility of great nonsense, because all the crazy ideas that have been batted down by the church in the last 50 years are likely to come out again in the parishes or in the dioceses. They won't go any farther, but I guess it allows people to vent and hopefully not continuing resentment that the church is never going to ordain women or change the sexual teaching or these kinds of issues. I don't think that's it about. But we do have to meet a culture which thinks that the church is profoundly wrong on a lot of those issues. And I think that'll be the importance of the synod to how are we going to work, evangelize this culture and catechize the Catholic people who polls have shown have departed from church teaching on a number of significant and essential issues of that teaching.
You know, in the 2,000 plus year history of the church, this whole notion of, regional bishops' conferences is a pretty new idea, isn't it?
It is. And this came up during John Paul II's pontificate, actually. And he issued a document, Apostolos Suis, his apostles. And in that, it talks about this relationship. Some wanted to say that each of the bishops' conference, a national bishops' conference, whether the American bishops' conference or randomly pick one, say the German bishops' conference, gets to...
How did I know you were going to pick that one?
They decide, you know, something, therefore it can have a universal effect in the church and be counted maybe at some level the equivalent of a general council or something. That's just not going to happen. And this argument was argued. There were essentially two positions, one referring back to the early church and the role of synods in those days. Cardinal Casper was the proponent of that one, as I recall. And another cardinal named Ratzinger was the proponent of what has been in the West the traditional view, of course, that only the hierarchy exercises authority, and the relationship between Rome and the different bishops' dioceses doesn't have a middle level of the bishops' conference. Every diocese is autonomous before the Pope, and every bishop, of course, as well, and they will all answer to the Lord. So there is no middle level. It's not General Motors. There is not a corporate structure to the church. The church, a particular church, is Catholic because it has the Catholic faith, the Catholic sacraments, and the Catholic communion. A bishop, his presbyterate, the diaconate, and the laity. That constitutes a Catholic church, and they are all in communion with each other because we have a principle of unity in the Roman pontiff, who exercises a primacy of authority as well as regarding teaching, the infallibility when that need exists. And so that's not going to doctrinally change. There is no middle position of synods. Our bishop here in Birmingham is responsible to the Holy Father. He's not responsible to whoever is president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops or whatever. There are certain things which Rome has devolved to the bishops' conference, and those are described in the law or in documents related to that, like the role of, you know, the first cut at the liturgical documents, those translations coming from the bishops' conferences, going to Rome more of with a placet, it pleases today than a red pen, but nonetheless, it's Roman authority that issues the final thing, and that will always be the case.
We're just getting started on a Friday edition of EWTN's Open Line. If you'd like to be on the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America, 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Join a deeper conversation about the most consequential issues facing Catholics today. You can do that on EWTN News In-Depth with Monse Alvarado. And you can get EWTN News In-Depth delivered straight to your inbox with details about each week's show. Just go to EWTN.com/in-depth and sign up today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. We've got a couple of open phone lines and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. First up today is Thomas in Eastern Tennessee, listening on iHeartRadio. Thomas, thanks so much for holding. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Colin, I want to ask you about Halloween. I've always celebrated the holiday as far as like watching horror movies and trick-or-treating as a kid, but recently I've seen some stuff that as Catholics you're not supposed to take part of it because it's like somebody said it's a demonic pagan holiday, and I was just curious if what was good and bad about this holiday, or if it's a holiday at all, and if we're allowed to celebrate it at all as far as Catholics.
Yeah, I grew up at a time when nobody gave that a second thought, and kids went out as Catholic or not and did Halloweening and so on. I think it has got more overtly demonic. Before it was, you know, a kid dressed up as Roy Rogers, for those of you who remember who he was, or something like this, and, you know, you went door to door, you got the candy. That's what it's about for the kids. The origins of it are in the Celtic practices, the pre-Christian practices of Ireland, and in many of those things, the church there, as it has at different times, was tolerant of not of the pagan practice, but tried to reorient it in a Christian way. This has always been the church's way to not, you know, take a sledgehammer to the problem, but to get it reoriented. So you look at what the church did in Rome in the early days. It built churches. It tore down the temples, but it built churches on top of them. It shows who's the victor here. The victor is Christ. And so throughout Rome, in fact, throughout Europe, the old Roman Empire, you find that there are many cases where a principal church will be built on top of something that was pagan. It illustrates this conquering of Christ point. You know, Christ conquers, Christ reigns, Christ is now the emperor, if you will. Christ rules. So that element of it is there, certainly, I think, in the Irish mentality, although I would say the modern Halloween is more of a commercial creation, a Hallmark card moment and a candy selling moment. And I think for kids who do it, I remember how Mother used to celebrate it here. I think it was before you were working here, Jack, where she would have all the neighborhood Catholic kids. They would put on holy costumes and so on, and there would be something on the set. And
well, that's
so
really
on.
How it kind of started, was
yeah.
the Christians dressing up as saints.
Right.
And many of them were religious order saints and clergy, and that's kind of how the trick-or-treating thing got started, was they would go around and beg for alms the way that the religious would beg for alms.
Yeah, and it was a reorientation of that practice. And I think when a parish does it, as happens, or a Catholic, you know, troop or something like that, or a group of Catholic friends, or even in a Catholic, in a neighborhood where it's predominantly just going to door and getting, you know, kids candy for the kids. Here in Irondale, they'll often have the fire truck downtown or something like that, and they'll distribute the candy, and the firemen will maybe do stuff for the kids. So, you know, it can be a wholesome celebration, but if everybody is dressing up as the latest demonic figure from some movie, which distorts reality in kids' psychology, then that's not good. And that's why I think the saint aspect or innocent cultural things, you know, to dress up as Abraham Lincoln or something like this, obviously that's not an evil thing to do.
You know, I noticed a couple years ago somebody in a hockey mask with a chainsaw that had kind of your same gait. I was wondering.
No, that wasn't me. I don't own any hockey masks. Although I do have a puck from the Blackhawks in the championship year. The last one.
When they were still playing with pucks. The one before that, I don't know that they were using pucks. I think they were knocking pine cones around the riverbed or something.
Well, that was when hockey was invented up in Canada, yeah. Right?
Is that helpful at all, Thomas, for you?
It is, and I was curious about that because I have a young daughter, and I want to go door to door, but I didn't want to, you know, partake in something that was not good. Obviously, we would do like a, you know, Snow White or pumpkin costume, and we want to be something.
Yeah,
like
that's innocuous.
Listen,
you know,
you know, where'd the name come from? It's All Hallows Eve.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm all for people say get hung up on the pagan origins of this thing. Hey, listen, I'm all for redeeming pagan practices.
Yeah.
I don't think we should be afraid of that. And, you know, even, you know, my lovely wife and I don't see completely eye to eye on this particular issue, you know, and I just don't think we can pull up the drawbridge and sit in our little Catholic castle and
yeah, I think this is the difficulty, especially that parents with young children face. If you reduce it to nothing, you run the risk that your kids will stop listening to you on other more important things. If you maintain this sort of the Catholic approach to this, as we did growing up, nobody thought twice about these other things. It's because our culture has gotten that bad that it is given, you know. And granted, there are people out there who say, you know, nada to anything that even smacks of that. But I think the All Hallows Eve and the saintly approach and or just cultural figures or historical figures, those are healthy ways of approaching it and finding that mean point that doesn't, you know, make your kid look like the Frankenstein in the neighborhood, literally, in some sense.
That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Next up is Matthew in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio. Matthew, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Gentlemen, I appreciate your call and your programming in general. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for it. Mr. Donovan, I have a question with regard to what seems to me, at least, to be a new role within the church, or at least within certain archdioceses, New York and St. Louis to be specific, and that's the role of chancellor. And I had never heard of such a thing in 57 years, but now I hear that the New York chancellor of the archdiocese is behind not wanting to issue religious exemptions to the COVID vaccine. And here in St. Louis, the chancellor is involved in a strategic planning effort. I was looking for some insight, theologically or otherwise, as to what this role is, how long it's been around, and what it actually entails. And I'll listen off air. Thank you very much.
Sure. I think we're all familiar that the church has a record-keeping practice. You know, if you want to trace your ancestors, you will find that a good place to go is back to the old country and look at the baptismal records. These are kept around essentially forever unless they're destroyed by fire or other things. So the church keeps records of baptisms, confirmations, marriages, ordinations, even some stages of different ordinations. And it keeps records of marriage in marriages and also tribunal results. So there is a huge record-keeping task in every diocese. That's the chancellor's role, and to sign official documents to show to the entire diocese, the bishop signs it, the chancellor signs it, that this is now formally established in his particular law in this place and represents that to everyone in the diocese. It's a canonical role. It's in the Code of Canon Law, which describes its responsibilities. I'm not sure the full extent of that, but it would also probably permit the bishop to, give responses don't require the responsibilities that don't require the power of the keys. So there was a change under John Paul II that allowed women to do the role of chancellor, and in some dioceses you will see that very often a sister, because it is principally this record-keeping role. It's not a hierarchical office in that sense, an administrative office of the diocese, and therefore it's open not just to clerics but to lay people. And being open to lay people, there are laymen who are chancellors, and there are also religious women and lay women, typically canon lawyers, people who have studied canon law and are thoroughly competent in that office and in that role. So it's been there. It's gotten a little bit more attention, probably because maybe you're paying more attention or something. But there's nothing particularly, difficult with it. It's something the church has done for a very, very long time. The very fact that we know what the canons of the early ecumenical councils were is because they were written down, promulgated, and recorded in multiple places, no likely, but obviously originally where those councils were held. Likewise, any of the Western councils, the First Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, Council of Trent. So that's the role, it's a longstanding responsibility. Whether the role has always had that name, that I can't tell you.
And how would that differ from Vicars General?
The Vicar General is usually a clergyman, usually the most senior clergyman appointed. He has the various deans, this other subdivision, the deaneries, and so on. So in that sense, there is a little hierarchy in the diocese.
I've heard it described as kind of a chief of staff.
Right, yeah, except because it's a vicar role, it has to be a cleric that satisfies that.
And then, of course, we here in the Diocese of Birmingham, and I know in other places, have a couple that are charged with various
different responsibilities. Canonical vicar, I believe, our chancellor is also that role, Father Jerebek, and then for other roles as well.
Yeah, very good. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America, wide open phone lines for you, and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That's openline@ewtn.com. And put something like Friday or Colin in the subject line, and we'll get it to the appropriate location. Or you can text your question. Text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for a response. Text your first name and your question. Message and data rates may apply. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free phone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. Next up is Daniel in Granger, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Daniel, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hello, sir.
Hey, Daniel. What's your question today?
My question is, when God created everything in the world, did he name all the stars one by one? That was my question.
Okay. Well, the stars came along for the most part through natural processes after that. Its use as a name also for the angels, and so for that sense, he did name all the angels. He has their he has the names that he gave them that describes their mission. But as for the natural stars, at least certainly the names that we know are given by various cultures. A lot of the Arab societies, the Arab culture gave name to many of them. I remember learning celestial navigation in the Navy, and you had to know all these principal stars, be the first ones that came out and so on each night to nav by. And then a lot of them were Arabic names, Aldebaran and others. So that's the history of the naming of the stars. Whether God actually named them in some respect at the time that they came about by the processes he set in motion is something we can wait and ask him, because he's certainly not revealed that he has done so.
We've got an email here from Bob that's interesting. He says, I am a catechist for RCIA at our parish. We have a nuanced question that came up regarding the penance imposed by a priest after sacramental confession. We know the Catechism of the Catholic Church says in paragraph 1496 that one of the effects of the sacrament is, quote, remission, at least in part, of the temporal punishment resulting in sin. Our question is this: can the penance imposed by the priest in some cases remit all punishment due to sin, like a plenary indulgence? Or only all the sins actually confessed only at that particular visit? Or is it only a partial remittance of confessed sins possible during a confessional visit? We've gotten differing answers and can't find an answer to this particular question. The Catechism doesn't dig that deeply. Does the Church have a position on this?
It certainly does. The confessor can give you any penance that he wants, whether it remits all of the temporal punishment due to sin is in your own hands, because it's the conversion of your heart and your orientation away from sin. So in that way, it's like the indulgence of the Church. The Church says if you do this work, you can receive a plenary indulgence. You do this certain thing. You say the prayers for the Holy Father. You go to confession. Within 20 days before or after, you receive Eucharist, preferably on the day of the work, but not necessarily within a few days or so. In the end, it's your detachment from sin which determines whether that indulgence will be plenary or not. And the same thing in coming out of the sacrament of confession. You could be given the greatest possible penance that took you a week, but if your heart is not converted by it and you are not detached from your sins as a consequence of it, the purpose of the assignment of the penance is that you might be. And so in doing saying that Hail Mary or that seven rosaries, whichever it might be, in doing those...
I thought somebody was listening the last time.
Time I was right outside there at St. Paul's. I saw you there. In doing that Hail Mary or those seven rosaries, are you detached from sin? This comes from your heart. This is the contrition you bring to the sacrament. So the size of the penance doesn't really do it. Now, granted, in the ancient times, the reason that we have different, we don't have these penances today, they were much more severe, with the idea that the severity of the penance, and it certainly has a truth to it, you know, if you were You had to do this penance. You had to sit in sackcloth and ashes outside the church, usually for the three great sins of murder, apostasy, and adultery, as generally practiced at that time. Then you would be readmitted to Holy Communion at some point. And it was that call to do penance and that willingness to do it which sets your will in the right direction. It can have that effect, but you can imagine it having the opposite effect, hardening you against repentance and so on. So don't be concerned about that. Be concerned about the thoroughness of your own conversion, because that will determine whether, you know, you need to go and do indulgenced works or do more penance and so on so forth. In a way, we should always have an attitude of penance and offer things at times unrelated to having been assigned it by our confessor, to have a penitential spirit. That's what Fridays are for. Are we taking advantage of it? That's what Lent is for. Are we taking advantage of that? Are we doing other things throughout the day, withholding that harsh word we might say, when it's be fully justified in giving it? There's all kinds of things we can do with a penitential spirit, you know, that says, you know, Lord, let me show the mercy to others that you show to me. So don't get hung up on the size of the penance the confessor gives you.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Next up is Greg in Montgomery, Alabama, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Greg, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hello, Colin.
Hey there.
My question is one, a philosophical question.
The worst kind.
It really has a lot to do with our idea of the creation providence model of God's creation of the earth and everything in the universe in 6 days, and then resting. We now live in his providence. And I find it difficult when we say that, you know, the universe is billions of years old, and we can't expect or we can't understand that God could actually do that. But we're expected to believe at every Eucharistic sacrifice that the eternal, immortal, infinite God brings himself into the Eucharist for us, mm-hmm. which is the bigger miracle. If we the reason I say this is Thomas Aquinas said wrong thinking about creation ends up being wrong thinking about God. And I think it's important that we start to pay attention to how we think about creation and God's infinite power, especially in these times when we
Somewhere in there is a question.
I'm
going to take it at which is the bigger miracle, the incarnation, transubstantiation, or creation? And answer that, okay? I would, let's see what's at stake in all of them. In creation, it's creation ex nihilo. That applies on whether God created everything through special creation, as many fundamentalists would believe, taking literally the book of Genesis in that respect. That would apply whether God created it instrumentally through the laws which he created and which the angels oversee, as follows, I think, from Thomas's analysis of the role of the angels in creation and in the governance of creation. And so creation is ex nihilo, from nothing. That's a tremendous miracle. The incarnation is God uniting himself to that which he created. That seems almost an impossibility, but yet he did it. Creation ex nihilo becomes, curiously, physicists would argue that that's not exactly impossible. I think the incarnation seems more impossible in my own mind. And transubstantiation, that that incarnated God-man could be present really, truly, and substantially under the Eucharist, to me, that seems like the greatest miracle. That's my opinion. This is not quite angels dancing on the head of a pin area, but I think it is very academic and very philosophical, as you say. So I would say, from that point of view, transubstantiation pulls them all together, because God created everything from nothing. He united himself to that creation, and now he appears fully, God and man, under the forms of bread and wine. That seems to me the pinnacle of all of that activity.
Does that help at all, Greg?
Yes, but I just wanted to make one more statement. I think, just as a curiosity, you might want to watch a video called The End of Quantum Reality, where basically some of the smartest people in the world talk about God at every instant creating and holding in existence from the realm of quantum physics.
Well, the physicists can't get at this. This is a metaphysical problem. So I've argued with people most of my theological life on what they think is the crossing between physics and science. There was in the 80s, there were some silly ideas in this respect that somehow quantum physics and all of this, I forget the gentleman's name, Brian Swim, I think was his name. There was this effort to sort of describe everything in cosmological and physical form, to then say to make God acting outside of time is really acting within some dimension of the creation. I mean, the metaphysical absurdities that is brought up by this approach, to me, I find, you know, shows that the church's long-standing practice, there is science which deals with describing nature as it finds it, because it can't do anything other than that. Philosophy, which deals with the causes of those of that nature of being and essence and nature and so on, and theology, which then is the science of God and what is beyond either philosophy and science. Philosophy can aid science as the handmaid, as Thomas put it, the handmaid of theology. Science may serve an apologetic value, but in the end, it doesn't prove anything about theology. That's why it takes faith. If you could, from quantum mechanics or Newtonian or any others, demonstrate the existence of God, you wouldn't need faith. But we do need faith, and that's what makes it saving, because it's God acting in us, believing him, because he is God and we are not, and we accept what he teaches about himself and about the rest of it as well.
Be sure to check out Mast Appeal, featuring Colleen Kelly Mast, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Colleen takes your calls and offers 2 hours of free, friendly advice from a Catholic perspective. That's Mast Appeal, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on EWTN Radio. Next up is Leslie in the great state of Utah, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Leslie, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was raised in what I believe is called a high Episcopal church.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much Catholic in liturgy and ritual.
Yep.
We didn't recognize the Pope, but other than that, we were basically Catholic. I went to a parochial school run by a community of Episcopal nuns. And I believe it was every Saturday night we would meet in the common room, and she would take us through a rosary. I guess that's one decade is going around the group.
Mm-hmm.
And then other nights we would do a novena for, I don't remember how long. This is a long time ago. I was 10 to 12, which was a long time ago. Anyway, I am curious to know what the purpose of saying the rosary is for, if we're not told that it's being done for a certain purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what a novena is and what it's supposed to do.
Well,
and I'm still Protestant or you know, generic Catholic, Christian, but I'm this has been bothering me for some time.
Okay.
And I just kind of like to know, and you guys talk about it a lot. So
sure.
I figured you would be the ones to talk to.
You are going to sleep so well tonight. It's going to be awesome.
We can only hope
so.
We can almost hope so with the angels leading you into a deeper relationship with the Lord. First of all, I am not at all surprised by what you describe the Anglican Church. Or in America, the Episcopal Church. There's the Anglo-Catholics, which is the Catholic part of the Anglican Church, and then there's the Low Church, which is more Protestant. I know this because we lived in England, actually, the first time we lived in England and I was a child. We lived near Whitby, the famous city of Captain Cook and St. Hilda. And our next door, company had rented half of a house. It was basically a great house from the more aristocratic times of the English. And we had one half, and there was an older couple on the other side who were high church Anglicans. They went to the liturgy where they celebrated sometimes in Latin. They went to confession on Saturdays. Now, I don't know if they said the rosary, but this is characteristic of the of the high church Anglicans, very close. So there's where in the United States the high church Episcopalians get those practices from the very Catholic dimension of the Anglican Church, which I certainly saw as a child in England. On the issue of the rosary, well, the purpose of the rosary is sort of self-evident, but not really. The self-evident part that in the rosary, you're saying the Hail Marys, and the rosary, at least as Catholics practice it, and I presume given the Marian devotion and the love of Our Lady of Walsingham in England, the Anglicans also do this, meditating on those mysteries, the mysteries of the life of Christ and of Our Lady, obviously where it intersects with his life. And in doing that, you have the opportunity of what? Reflecting on the decisions they made and maybe the decisions you made. So the life of Christ and his mother are pedagogical to us because our reflecting on them or meditating on them would be the technical way of describing it. Meditating on those mysteries is telling us things with the help of grace, with the actual graces God gives us, to see things about the life of Christ and then maybe to say, whoa, there's an area where I need to clean up my own life. You know, the patience of Our Lady and Joseph when they lost Jesus in the temple. They did their job as parents. They went back looking for him. But imagine that. And we all have those circumstances in life. So the mysteries in that way give us this opportunity to reflect on the life of Christ and to reflect on our own life in view of it. And what that can tell us about the life of holiness, the life of grace, the life of fidelity to the will of God and all of that. So that's what the purpose is of the rosary, although the beads sort of keep your hands busy so that your mind can sort of detach a little bit and think about these things, and you don't have to think so deeply because it's really all very rote after a while. Not even thinking about the words, you're saying the words and thinking about the mystery. There, the meditation is a little bit deeper. And for the laity, the rosary can be a step to a true contemplative prayer where God intervenes and gives graces in those moments. And so in the convents and monasteries, the monks and nuns may be using more formal means of meditation in preparation to receive the grace of contemplative prayer. For the lay people, the rosary is very often the means of deepening their prayer life. And so that's the deeper reason, sort of the unseen reason for the rosary. And a novena is simply the imitation of the practices of the apostles that for 9 days prior to Pentecost, they didn't know what was happening, but they prayed during 9 days, and on that last day after, when they had finished, the Holy Spirit descended upon them. There's where the church gets the idea of a novena. When we really want something, the grace of our Lord, an increase of virtue, or even we need to find a good job or a good husband or whatever it is, a novena is the way to go, because it shows our persistence in prayer, our dedication to the will of God, and our humility to ask and to wait on God for the things that we need materially and spiritually. So both rosary and novena have great and tremendous spiritual purposes beyond the mundane fact of saying these vocal prayers and you know, passing beads through your fingers.
And just to clear up one possible misconception based on the way that you phrased your question, just from a logistical standpoint, you know, and the foundation of this was really, as you said, from the early religious brothers and sisters who would meditate on the Psalms.
Right.
There were 150 of those, and there are three. There were originally three groups of five mysteries, which, when prayed all the way through, would be 150.
Right. It
Hail
was
Marys.
For them a lectio divina, that's in right. other words, a contemplation on the Word of God in Scripture, which can be done with the Gospels, but their community practice was to pray the Psalms. And we still do that in the Liturgy of the Hours in the church, which is another great way for the laity to enter into that spiritual tradition of Catholicism.
And subsequently, a fourth group of prayers was added by Pope John Paul II.
The fourth set of
mysteries. Yeah, and so she said once through a whole thing, I think she was referring to a group of five mysteries. So that would not be that would not be a decad. That would be what would be considered a full rosary.
Right.
Would be any five of one of the groups of five mysteries.
Commonly is. Like at Fatima, when our Lady asked for the rosary in Portuguese, it was a terzo. It was a third, meaning one third of the full 15. So five.
Right. So a decad would be one of the mysteries.
One of the five mysteries of the joyful, sorrowful, luminous today, and the glorious.
How'd we do, Leslie?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Okay.
You're welcome. Next up is Sheila in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Sheila, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for you, Donovan, that I've had since I was a small child. And I've asked several priests, but no one's been able to answer it for me. And I hear you know the answer.
maybe not. But anyway, go ahead. All you can do is ask.
That's exactly right. So the question is, well, first of all of our devotionals, going to Mass, receiving communion, all have graces attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, there's kind of a finite amount of grace, depending upon what it is that you do or what devotional you pray. So like Holy Communion holds the greatest, right? So when you offer a rosary or the Mass that you're attending for someone, or the biggest question is, when you have multiple intentions, since there, as I understand, a finite amount of grace, how much does each person or thing you're praying for receive? Do they get equal amount? Is it divided according to the importance?
Sure. Yeah.
Or do they all get the whole amount?
Yeah. Let me answer, because I think we are running close to the clock now. So, no, your basic point is not the first time I've heard this question, because it's an obvious one. You go to Mass, everybody's offering their own intentions. With God, there's an infinity, of course, but we don't bring an infinity of devotion necessarily to that which we do. So a determining factor, obviously, the value of the saying the rosary, of course, has a value before God. The value of the purity of our intention and what we asking in particular for, this has value before God. It can't really be reduced to a mathematical fractions or proportions. You can imagine that a very devout and holy person, a Padre Pio or a St. John Paul II, could be asking something for 100 people and each of them receiving every grace that they needed. In fact, in heaven, you can imagine how many people are asking those two individuals for something, and every one of them are in some way being responded to. So I don't think we can conceive it mathematically. But what you bring is your good intention. You bring the act that you do that you wish to offer for this purpose, sort of like I was saying earlier with regard to doing your penance after going to confession. Do it with that pure intention, you know, and with a certain intensity of devotion doesn't mean gritting your teeth or anything like that, but that's really the purity and the seriousness with which you ask this. Then trust in God. I think that's the big thing. Because God is infinite. He doesn't have to dole it out by some mathematical formula. He can answer it all if that is indeed his will.
God bless you, Sheila. Thanks so much for the phone call. And that's going to be the final phone call of the week as we've come to the end of another week of EWTN's Open Line. On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, our producer, Michael McCall, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Jeff Burson, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks for another great week of EWTN's Open Line. We're back at it again on Monday with Father John Trigilio. Until we get together then, have a great weekend and God bless.